accession number 27753, reel 6.
Mr. Paul Cooper?
Yes.
Reel 6.
Yeah, this is here, Paul Cooper. I'm here. They were using the cordite bags, which are the explosives for these types of shells that they use. Some had been split. And these people, these young people, 5, 6, 8, were lining it up, the cordite, and lighting it to see it sizzle around in circles. What was the funniest part, again, so memorable? Watch this with great glee and interest, because I was on the deck just watching what was happening. And I saw this sizzling going on. And in fact, you know, a cordite, you can carve your name in a bit of wood by placing that, even at a cartridge today. It burns a hole wherever shape you put it. Anyway, they had been caught up in part on the sand, and then they put sand on top, packed it down. I thought, this is going to be interesting. And they were only about 3 or 4 feet away and set like this, and it was sizzling along. Well, you can guess what happened. When it hit this underneath the sand bank, wow, up it went. Sand blew them backwards. No harm, of course, but covered in sand, were padded down on top of the cordite. Another interesting thing of war, and the fun the kids were having with the explosive left behind. Well, I thought the shell wasn't. And of course, unless they were direct action impact shells, which obviously weren't, they were safe enough. And of course, generally speaking, it would be a detonator at the end. That one, but some of them were whole shells running down on the pebbles and seeing them through the water.
And this was just in the beaches of Sicily and Italy.
Yeah, in Italy.
I know the Germans had, the Germans, when they were in Sicily, they'd heavily mined the beaches and so
on. Yes, we never hit one, as I'm here today. But we certainly could have done in one of those. It was just a few, a few beaches from Messina, small beach, lovely beach actually. The houses were right on the edge of the beach, and hence the little packets. There was one kind of a monastery right on the beach that we were able, holes in the wall would have been shattered. And we were able to pick, I remember all of the lads. It wanted to, or allowed ashore, just up the beach, and came back with shirts full of pears and peaches and pomegranates, all fresh from this garden. Absolutely wonderful. Every fruit you could possibly think of, shirts full, all fresh stuff, you know, it really was. Very fascinating. Well, I think that is as much about Italy as I can think of at the moment.
Did you ever meet any German resistance in the time that you were in Sicily and Italy?
Not direct. That is, not face-to-face. They, of course, by that time, they'd been driven and had really gone, as you could say, most of them.
Gone.
Yeah, that's right, and gone across. Into Italy, because they'd given that up. After all, quite frankly, what was there in Sicily except Sicilians, you know? So most of them got out. There was no direct, we never had any direct resistance whatsoever. It was calm as could be, and the people that were in line defending whatever they could, thinking they'd hold the towns and that. Anyway, there was nothing of it, really.
How about air control from the Germans and the Italians?
By that time it was quenched. Yeah, quite quenched. And they were holding on like Montesino, which is quite crazy, absolutely crazy. But, and really, it was just this idea they destroyed the monastery, really, calling the Allies bluff. Which they proved that it was silly bluff, because shamefully they destroyed it, simple as that. Anyway, I think we should get on to Burma, really, because when it was decided, we always said that when we got North Africa, Sicily and Italy complete, dominated and finished the war there, then we were in Malta, and we had our orders to turn left, and that means that looking at the map and geography, you could see that we're going somewhere else other than back to Britain. And of course, at that stage, we say, anybody that was in the Burma campaign, there were only two or three of our landing craft went turned left. And the others, right back, as we say, Burma campaign people, they lifted up for 2 years before D-Day. Till everything was ready. It's all very well, a terrible battle. Really blame the French for that, I say, which is a terrible indictment. But they capitulated, and we could have lost the whole army there originally at Dunkirk, which is frightful, because that's where I've been five times in the last 4 months, to aunts and uncles and things. And mummies in law. And of course, the treaty, I got a lovely testimonial from one of the aunts whose father was killed by the Germans. Again, in France, the liberator, Paul Cooper, of course, which is rather funny, if you like, but that's how they treat me as they consider a part relative, I suppose, and thanks too, which is interesting enough. Anyway, to Burma we went out through the Suez and the Red Sea, and then docked at Aden, then to
Remember the period that you went out there? What year or month?
No, but that's easy to recall, because it was just before the when the Japanese were building up to, I can work it out, were building up, and they knew perfectly well that India was where, because they were about to invade them.
The jewel of the British Empire.
We stopped them. Boy, we stopped. Anyway, off we went Bombay. Now this Bombay, Aden, was an interesting place that I remember I took my first patrol out. I'll say little about that, but I was asked if I would take a patrol ashore there. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, but what I do know, I will merely say that it was a strange mission, because within a few minutes of me telling them what they had to do, which I was a bit vague about, I knew there were a street about, I think there was at least 15 shacks either side, so-called flats or whatever. Shacks to me, and I could say at one time I couldn't see any patrol, but what I did learn very rapidly, and I'll say very briefly, free to the patrol.
What do you mean?
What it says. And I'll go no further, but again, a great eye-opener to me, because they were going in the front door and out the back, and you might put two and two together and wonder why within a few minutes they were coming out the back, you might say refreshed as far as they were concerned.
Right.
You get what I mean. I should go no further.
What were you doing?
Well, I was guarding of the patrol. No, it was my patrol, and I had to keep check. And this is where I was told several times, going to see where they'd gone, saying, "Feet of the patrol, Johnny," you know, which I thought was a bit out of my line, and realised, oh well, this is, then they come out the back, hole, you know. But I gathered them all up eventually. It was quite a few hours we spent there.
What was the point of the mission?
Pardon?
What was the point of the patrol?
Well, to see that none of the naval ratings went anywhere near there. And then I lost them.
Uh-huh.
I could do nothing about it. They were patrolling, uh-huh. You see. Yeah. Rather interesting.
So that nothing was achieved from it?
Nothing at all.
Right.
Only into the lion's den, because they, I think there were 12 men. Goes the 12 men.
Off your landing craft?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Half the ship's company. Anyway, that was in then to Bombay. And this is where taking on the oil from this huge ship, which was an experience and a bit and a great, great survival business. Uncanny, really. Quite uncanny. Or I think of it, I don't know how, because we were tied alongside astern in this huge ship, towering. How many feet? 30, 40 feet above, taking on oil astern, just astern, immediately astern on it. Certainly within 2 or 3 meters, taking on oil. And it had been gone through a few hours of the morning, ready to proceed to burn. And the skipper suddenly rather said, "Go on. Now, I've got a date ashore and I'm going. Tell the motormac to stop taking on. We'll come back later this evening. I'm going ashore. We'll anchor at the buoy out here about 1/4 mile. And pointed to it. So, told the motormac, secured the pipes and tail, you know, the oil compartments, I should say, and proceeded to the buoy. And within minutes, I can't explain it, because today it happened. And only afterwards can you realize you're alive. The 5 square miles of Bombay Harbour and that ship vanished. And we were only there a few minutes before. The skipper had just had time to change, and as he came up on board, the explosion. We were on deck, and I remember in those flashes that blown backward and him being splattered with oil, and that ship vanished. This huge, huge ship. And 5 square miles, the largest explosion before the atomic bomb dropped in Bombay Harbour. It cleared out the harbour, which was far off the city. I've only met one man who knows anything about that was in Bombay at the time. And when I told him, he couldn't believe that anybody had survived there. And of course, dozens of ships galore were sunk and burnt out, and we took a big ship. That's again the survival of my feet. We took a big ship burning in tow to get it away from the harbour with people splattered around, and I was watching. We'd got a line of course, to pass one of the ship's cable, burnt out and still burning, back 2 hours around the bollard, and at the hatchway I was watching this take the strain, and of course obviously it would be terribly weakened by the fire, which was 20 minutes since we could breathe as we donned on. It was overpowering. We put on gas masks and still then could only just breathe with fumes of cordite and oil. Really, yes, very serious. We were suffocated. But I watched it take on the strain, and at the moment I stood back on the coping, which was the space where the hatch closes, about, was it, foot, eight, 10 inches high. As I stood back, the cable gave way and cut a hole below my feet, where it would have cut my both feet off above the ankles within fractions of seconds. And knocked me forward, where it hit underneath. Great, not only explosion survival, but even with the cable, which had been fired and weakened very much indeed, just smashed the eye, the hook, the whatever, oh, I forget the term of the, or that had been round the bollard, which had been spliced, a weakness, you see, burnt, and the internal center of the cable burnt and weakened, and just went and held the Coleman underneath my feet.
It came whipping back this
cable. Yeah, that's right. Underneath, and cut a hole, oh, 18 inches, foot or 18 inches, right through the metal. And that was one of the stronger parts of metal around the Coleman, the actual opening to the ship itself.
This is where the ramp was
front. Yeah. But, again, tremendous survival of injury, and of course incredible overall survival, just incredible. I can't explain that, nobody can explain it, and I've only met one person in the Midlands that ever had heard anything about it. Wartime, you see, terrible tragedy.
What had happened in Bombay Harbour?
Well, what had happened, apparently there had been a smouldering fire on board, and nobody said a word. Everything under control, and fumes eventually combusted, and the whole lot went.
This was a huge ship,
vanished. How we weren't obliterated with shrapnel or the equipment on. Bells came down, and of course, as big as the chair, were coming down seconds afterwards. Fortunately, none hit us. It doused on fire with dead Indians. It's terribly pathetic. I have to pinch myself today, but it was real, but it was.
Were you far out of the harbour?
Oh no, not out of the harbour. Only out for a buoy. We had to get back in the evening, quarter of a mile at the most. Right absolutely in it. And really, you just felt this implosion type of thing. You know, a breath's gone, and then the fumes, which were overpowering. People were on the ground. Some of the crew, on the ground. Gasping for breath. I remember I was, but gas mask always handy anyway. But that did little good, because it was thick, absolutely thick, and explosive.
So I went back into Bombay Harbour to see if you could help.
Oh well, we were in it trying to collect people and bodies and debris, and as I say, taking the flaming stuff away from anything that might be reclaimable. And I remember, I don't think it got anywhere, of course the salvage money, you see, I think this is what, I don't think they ever got any, we certainly didn't receive any as a crew. Anyway, then sailed on to Chittagong, and soon after that we went into Calcutta temporarily, and at that time 44 at that time there were 2,000 a day dying of cholera, and I recall very well that they were dead in the street. I know this sounds highly exaggerated, but I can assure you anything I've said is not. Nothing. It's real. And I know that many people say you've made that up. I can't make things up as a story, nor talk freely about them as phony. But in the street, dying. What I remember most is not Indian dying of cholera, but they had posters, rather large posters, about 2 feet by 18 inches, with a big fly as big as your two hands, and it said simply in English, can kill in 24 hours the fly, contamination on corpses or any fresh old food. I remember going in the market, we hadn't seen any fresh eggs, for instance. And there was always boys in India, boys to help us, called boys. You could say a penny a day, they cook for you, they do your laundry, and look after you generally. And I went into the market with my boy, so-called, who did the laundry and had it back within hours, beautifully white and starched if necessary. And he took me into the market, which is where I wanted to go. Wonderful, wonderful place. He said he knew the market and knew who to go to best for eggs. So we went to the eggs and they said, how many ones? So I think I said, I could speak up with them. Stanley still remember a bit of the day. But I said, you know, something like 24 would do. And he said, told this one Indian how many I wanted. He made him light a candle and hold everyone in front of the candle to see if they were fresh. Everyone. Yeah, which was all new to me. He made them light the candle, and that was the routine that the marketer person had to be able to show a customer, certainly a customer, that they were fresh.
How did you tell they were fresh?
Well, you see a blob in the middle instead of all smoky, foggy, because the actual yolk shows whole. Yeah. I remember that very distinctly. Remember Furpo's, the most posh restaurant, one of the poshest in the world, and I've visited most of them in New York, Madrid, and London. The post office tower was I used to go to regularly before the IRA was attempted to destroy it, and they stopped public going into it. But I proposed was the most grand, about five boys to each table, and every kind of delicious food possibly done in the most glorious manner, which I used to eat.
So you were able to live it up for a little while?
Oh yes, because I didn't smoke. I didn't drink a lot now, I don't now. I'm particularly fond of brandy, and if and Richard came with a lobster, I would probably smoke salmon. When you heard, we should be still drinking cognac. We might have had a coffee, but I doubt it. Food, glorious food. Now, after a while after the initial battle at Chittagong, where so many were killed, I had said, I think initially, reckoned to be 34,000-35,000 killed of different nationalities, including about 9/10 Japanese at that time. They realised after, I think it was about after another 6 or 8 months into 45, that we had been arrested from actual combat for just on 4 years. And so we were asked, where we'd like to go for a rest, and we had a list of houses, Maharaja's residences in the central provinces. I chose Jodhpur, Maharaja's house, beautifully apart, and it's up with two boys, so-called waiters, cooks, chefs, and laundries. They cooked what I wanted for almost 2 weeks, lived it up, and then back to war, and kept going. I take it, and this is the time soon after that when we'd had several ashore, sent ashore unfit for sea service or service of any kind, so we lost crew. This is the time when Mountbatten, Admiral Mountbatten, was the commander of the Royal Navy forces from the Middle East. When he said to us, personally, I could say personally to a number of us, I can get no supplies and no replacements for you. I've tried, but there's none coming. You are the forgotten army. Now I say, we were then, and we really are today. Nobody really has heard very much that there was any such thing as a Burma bomb. I say this because a lot of people died, a lot of our soldiers died, the Gurkhas galore, which are the most wonderful fighting men you could possibly ever hope to meet, and we met hundreds of them. We knew perfectly well when we dropped them in the jungle. We had our mass collapsible so we could push up into the jungle, the chunks, the rivers, as deeply as we possibly could. Rivers from tiny flows.
Yes, we're still using your large landing craft.
Yes, yes, and a mass collapsible brush on either side and snakes as long as a boat, and I'm not kidding you. We realized then that we were alone and nothing. It's rather interesting to me because I moved the central motion on the Speaker of the House. I think it's 3 years now, no more. Betty Boothroyd, and I used to like to watch Today in Parliament with the television over there, which we got rid of some years ago, must be 5 years, when she got up after the parliamentary the Prime Minister's answers, and said we have a celebration in the Westminster Hall on June the 6th to celebrate the end of World War II. And that, what? That is wrong. So straight away I ran House of Parliament. I got an answer and asked if I could speak to my local MP, Ian Bruce, Dorsetshire MP, who was in the House and came to the phone. So I said, I wish to move a central motion on the Speaker of the House. What? You know, very nicely. So I told him why. And I said, I know perfectly well I was. And it was at the end of World War II. It was the end of the war in Europe, but not in Burma. And I was there. And I said, I know perfectly well. We splashed the main brace on our landing craft just off Akyab in Burma on that day. And I remember, and she is wrong. They came to see me in the evening, and next day moved the censure motion on the Speaker of the House. My brother heard it in Guernsey and rang up within seconds and said, is that my baby brother who moved the censure motion? But eventually, obviously, she was a bit put out by it, but eventually I had a letter and realising that not made a mistake exactly, but it was not quite correct what she had said.
You, just for the tape, you said June the 6th that you were meeting the end of the war, you're May the 7th, I think.
Yes, I don't know that date. But this is what the date she was saying on this in the Westminster Hall, a celebration of the end of World War II. I knew that to be very wrong. I was cross, very cross about it, but he came and got quite friends with me, came two or three times.